When Jennifer Harris disappeared from Bonham, Texas on May 12, 2002, investigators had very limited information about where she went and why. And when her body was discovered in the Red River 6 days later, what was missing from the scene was nearly as important as what was found.
So the fact that Jennifer's uterus was missing, you know, that got a lot of attention and it got a lot of people talking about, and they removed her uterus to hide the fact that she was pregnant. And, you know, then you couldn't do a DNA test and that sort of thing.
Another theory in the early days was that Jennifer had possibly ended her own life after a battle with depression.
If she killed herself, where are her clothes? If she killed herself, where's her purse? If she was depressed and she wanted to end it all, why would she lock her vehicle and take all of her personal effects with her? Her keys, her purse, etc.
Physical evidence doesn't just disappear on its own. Someone had gotten rid of Jennifer's clothes, purse, and keys.
Fire is often used to sanitize evidence.
And that person was almost certainly Jennifer's killer.
Offenders don't have to do a lot of stuff for the homicide of a woman to not be solved, especially when they know how to manipulate the situation based on the victim's history.
Join me as we try to discover what happened to Jennifer Harris and who was responsible for her death. From Cold Case Productions, this is Final Days on Earth, Season 2, The Life and Death of Jennifer Harris, Episode 10, The Fire. I'm your host, Claire Sanima. Thanks for listening. For the past 9 weeks, we've been going through the investigation into the disappearance and death of Jennifer Harris. We've covered Jennifer's movements during her final days, the period in which her friends and family waited in limbo when she was simply a missing person, and the ultimate discovery of her body. We've also touched on the bizarre and suspicious behavior of the two persons of interest as identified by law enforcement, Jennifer's ex-boyfriend, James Hamilton, and her ex-husband, Rob Holman. But there's more to our story. More that happened in the otherwise sleepy town of Bonham on the night Jennifer disappeared. It's a potentially explosive correlation that had been overlooked for years by the original authorities on the case. And it's a pretty hot topic for investigator Daryl Parker, who finally put the pieces together.
So, there's something we've been waiting to talk about for a long time in this case, and that is the fire. Tell me when you learned that fire might have played a role in Jennifer's case.
It could just be a coincidence, but in my line of work, there are no coincidences.
I mean, this wasn't common knowledge in the days of the investigation. I've been through this case file backwards and forwards. I don't see a mention of a fire anywhere.
Right.
When Daryl Parker first started working at the Fannin County Sheriff's Office in 2009, he did what any good investigator would do. He endeavored to retrace the path of Jennifer Harris's killer.
I knew where her body had been found, and in my training for investigations, and I've seen the studies that say that a human body that's put into a body of water, like a river, with enough volume to carry a human body, generally they are found within 1.5 to 2 miles from where they're put in the water.
Given the parameters, Daryl calculated an area to search for a plausible entry point along the Red River, somewhere Jennifer's killer would have had an opportunity to place her body in the water.
So when I started looking at the properties along the river, well, they're all private. And so this is the first piece of land where you can get to the river, and it's pretty isolated.
Daryl came upon a patch of land that was privately owned, but without fencing or gates. In other words, open to the public. The thing was, it was dilapidated and appeared to be in ruins. He began investigating this property and found that it was owned by the Whitlocks, a local Bonham family, whose main residence was still very much intact and standing. It was clear to Daryl that the piece of land at the front of the property once held a structure, given the fact that the foundation was still exposed. He was curious about what happened, how this small wooden cottage fell into its current state, and after digging around more, he discovered a surprising bit of history about this property, something that dovetailed with the Jennifer Harris case, something that had been smoldering in the background the entire duration of the investigation. A mysterious fire had engulfed the original structure, the very night of Jennifer's disappearance.
So, at the time that Jennifer disappeared, it was getting ready to rain. So, sometime between 8:12 and midnight.
That fire burned.
Yes. And when the fire department got there, the cabin was already fully engulfed, so they just let it go ahead and burn. But this was a night where it had already rained, so it was already wet. Why would a cabin spontaneously combust? It did not. The fire department determined that it was arson. So somebody intentionally set it on fire.
Yeah, that's a fascinating set of circumstances that all had to collide for that particular fire to occur in that location.
Yes, and so in the context of a crime, why is that important? Because fire is often used to sanitize evidence, you know? People will shoot and kill a person and leave them in the house and try to burn the house down, hoping that that will cover up the shooting. And that's one thing. That's an entire human body. But when we're just talking about trying to get rid of clothing, a purse, car keys, then and you throw that into a cabin and set it on fire, you're just not going to find that stuff.
While technically private property, the Whitlocks were known to be generous with their land. And at that time, many locals accessed the Red River there. Today, there are posted no trespassing signs, and the property appears a little more secure. Back in May 2002, the small wooden structure didn't have electricity running to it, and there was no evidence that it caught fire on its own by a lightning strike or any natural means. Authorities determined that the fire at the Whitlocks was suspicious and criminal. But what happened next made for an even more interesting night in Bonham. According to a statement from the fire chief at the time, he had just started to respond to a fire near the Red River when he got a call that there was a second fire at a property a few miles away, owned by the Brindley family. Mr. Brindley stated that before the fire had started, he saw a man in a pickup truck stop in front of a small storage structure on his property. As the truck drove off, the structure had started to burn down. The volunteer fire department responded, but all they could do was set a wet line to stop the fire from spreading. The property burned to the ground and was reportedly ruled as arson. All the while, just a few miles away, the first fire was still burning over on the Whitlock property, just a stone's throw from the Red River. Daryl Parker thinks there's room for both fires to be related to Jennifer's case.
Let's say someone dismembers a victim and they'll try to go around and put pieces in different dumpsters. That could have been very well what happened. Who knows? And someone who is arguing, you know, devil's advocate could say, well, you know what? This was just a couple of teenagers and they were going around starting fires. And the cabin didn't have anything at all to do with Jennifer Harris's death. You didn't find anything there, right? Well, yeah, you can say that. But I think the circumstances point to it definitely being used to destroy evidence. The circumstances about this other thing that burned down, I really don't know the details of that, so I can't say. But it may have been a secondary point to get rid of evidence. You know, maybe the clothes went into the cabin and her purse and her keys went into the other building.
And not only is fire a way to cleanse and destroy, fire is bold and distracting, passionate even.
I think most of the time, people who use fire to destroy evidence, it is a crime of passion or an unplanned situation. Because if they had planned it, then it would be, they would be more discreet about the way they got rid of their evidence. So I think fire typically is more often used when it's an unplanned event.
While the fire at the Brindley property doesn't have a clear relationship to Jennifer's case, the fire at the Whitlock property is another story.
When I started looking at the case, you know, I noticed that one condition of the body is that she had this mud on her, and this was this blue mud, blue marl mud.
Daryl interviewed Eugene Dollar, the fisherman who found Jennifer's body, and asked him about the blue mud.
He told me that there was only two places on the Red River where that mud was normally found, and one of them was right there next to the 78 Bridge. That also coincides with a piece of private property where it has easy access. There's no fences or gates, that sort of thing, and it has a primitive boat ramp down to the water.
What Eugene is describing is consistent with the Whitlock property in Bonham, where the fire was set, just a couple miles upriver from where Jennifer's body would later be found.
That's the most likely insertion point for Jennifer's body. And then suddenly, by coincidence, the little caretaker's cottage at the front of that property burns down the same night.
That is pretty surprising that this fire would have occurred on the exact same night of Jennifer Harris's disappearance at a location where it is conceivable that her body was put into the water because of this specific type of blue mud that was found in just a few points on the Red River and is also found on her body.
And not just about the mud. You know, there have been studies done by the FBI about what happens to a human body when you put it into a river with enough volume to carry a human body. Typically, they come to shore. They will rise and come to shore within 1.5 to 2 miles from where they were inserted, which is exactly the right distance to get to that point. So those two things are pretty good evidence that she was put into the water there. And the cabin burned down not just the same day, any time during that day, that night after Jennifer had disappeared.
In June 2022, I went out to the scene of the fire with Daryl Parker.
All right, this is 1396. This is the last paved road they would have used. Now, I got to figure out where there's a turnoff. It's a major dirt road.
Okay.
Turns to the right before we hit 78 again.
We had quite a time locating the Whitlock property ourselves.
Tell me how someone who's not from around here is going to find this place.
So there's the Red River, 78 Bridge. This is County Road 2000. And the Whitlock property.
I just saw Whitlock on the mailbox there.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Once we got to the Whitlock property, we hopped out of the car and took a look around.
Can we get out here?
Yeah, sure.
We saw what was left of the structure that had burned down, what Daryl had seen back in 2010. It was just a small concrete slab foundation.
This is part of the foundation for the little cottage.
Okay. And so it was a little wooden cottage?
It was a little wooden cottage and like that.
Okay.
That is a piece of melted glass from the original windows.
Okay, that's amazing.
Yeah.
See that? So this is from the fire.
That's from the fire.
Wow.
Yep. I actually have a piece of that melted glass that I kept. Keep it in my desk.
After Daryl learned about the fire, he brought out a class of police academy recruits to excavate the scene in 2010. Better late than never.
So all of this, we were able to sift. You know, we had screens and metal detectors, and we laid out our lines, and we did it in a very organized manner. We found a
collar off of a cat. Okay. And because Jennifer had a dog, it was a lab.
That's right, Patton.
No, it's got a vet number on it. Let's go run it with the vet. Oh, wow. So we took it to a vet, ran it through the vet, and he was like, no, it's a cat named Smokey or whatever.
Okay.
So, so nothing, we didn't find anything in here that was useful.
By design or coincidence, the fire that burned on the shores of the Red River on May 12, 2002 had left no trace of evidence in the Jennifer Harris case.
So, this is where I think she was killed, because I don't think he would have driven around with her body in the truck. I don't think he would have done that. I think they came up here. He expected that they would have sex like they had been doing, and they got into an argument about the baby. Maybe they had already had sex. Maybe that's why she was naked. And it turned violent.
At the time of her murder, Jennifer was romantically involved with both Rob Holman and James Hamilton. It's important to note that both men have repeatedly denied being with Jennifer on the night she disappeared. No one has ever been charged in relation to Jennifer's case. But because the information about the fires didn't come up until much later in the investigation, it sparks additional interest in the minds of the current cold case investigators. Claire Sanima here, host of Final Days on Earth. Let's talk about your best defense for the unexpected. Are you prepared if the unthinkable happens? If a medical emergency arises, Air Medcare Network provides members with world-class emergency air transport services to the nearest hospital with no out-of-pocket expenses. Join today and never pay a dime for your medical flight when flown by an AMCN provider. Insurance doesn't always cover the full cost of a medical emergency, so this is a great way to secure financial peace of mind. Memberships cost as little as $85 a year for your entire household. And right now, as a listener of my show, you'll get up to a $50 Visa or Amazon gift card with a new membership. Visit airmedcarenetwork.com/final and use offer code FINAL. No matter where you're at the game of life, an Air Medcare Network membership is the protection no one should live without.
This is Allison Brett from The Prosecutors, and we are excited to announce our new show, The Prosecutors Legal Briefs. Each week, we'll bring our experience as prosecutors to true crime in the news. Whether it's breaking developments in a case, the intricacies of sentencing, or analysis of what's really going on in cases like the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp defamation trial, we'll have you covered.
So if you're looking for the latest in true crime from a different point of view, The Prosecutors Legal Briefs is the show for you. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
The possible connection of arson in the Jennifer Harris case piqued my interest, so I reached out to one of my favorite criminologists, Dr. Claire Ferguson, in Queensland, Australia. Dr. Ferguson has been studying crime scene staging and detection avoidance behaviors by murderers for over 15 years. She's among the world's foremost experts in this fascinating and emerging field of research. Listeners to Season 1 of this podcast will recognize Dr. Ferguson's name from Damien Hurt's case. Features of staged homicides are one of Dr. Ferguson's areas of expertise. And, as fate would have it, arson-associated homicide is another one.
So it kind of course, falls under the banner of concealment. And most of my research is around different types of detection avoidance.
In 2015, Dr. Ferguson was the lead author on a study in trends and issues in crime and criminal justice titled Arson-Associated Homicide in Australia. A five-year follow-up.
The problem with the arson research kind of across the board is that it destroys evidence. So studying arson can be tricky because a lot of the evidence, you don't know what people necessarily did because the evidence has been burned. That's kind of the point.
Dr. Ferguson broke down the two main categories of her research.
In the research, we generally characterize arson-associated homicides as either primary arson or secondary arson. So basically, that's where the person died from the fire, or the person was already dead before the fire was set. Some research breaks it up even further into like whether the body itself was burned, either primary or secondary, or whether a structure was burned primary or secondary. But the broadest categories are those ones where the fire was actually used as the murder weapon, and then when the fire was used as concealment. So in this case, or as evidence destruction, in this case, we would be talking about secondary arson associated homicide, if indeed the arson is associated with the homicide.
Right. And I noticed that in your study, it said that it was extremely rare and accounted for only 2% of total homicides. You know, why do you think it's so rare?
Well, I think that's probably an underestimation. So I think especially for secondary arson-associated homicides, we probably don't record those as often as they actually happen, because you mightn't know that someone has destroyed evidence using fire. For example, if they have a fire pit in their backyard or they have a fireplace, they might have just burned something or whatever. They might have just held on to it and burned it. So you wouldn't necessarily know about that. I think that's the major reason. But I think also people probably use other forms of evidence destruction that might be quicker and draw less attention more often. So instead of burning clothes, put them in a dumpster, for example. However, that is about opportunity. If there isn't a dumpster to put them in, or, you know, some remote place, then that might be less likely to happen.
I mean, if we're talking about Jennifer's case and we're going down the theory that, you know, she was killed over by the river, she was thrown in the river. At that point, the killer had her clothes and her purse and had to do something with them. You know, from a criminology standpoint, if the body's thrown in the river, does it make as much sense for the offender to also throw the items in the river? Or is it like, well, I already put her body there, I need to do something different with these other pieces of evidence?
I think depending on who the offender is and how clearly they're thinking, there's more risk associated with putting the clothes into the water or just leaving them in the forest or whatever, because knowing that this is going to be probably first a missing persons investigation, they would have known that that area is going to be scoured for evidence. So burning them is an additional safeguard against them being found. And also, in the middle of nowhere, the opportunity presents itself to burn something more so than it would have in an urban place where if you start a fire, someone's going to call police pretty much straight away. And the thing is about fire, if someone does call it in, you have just really screwed yourself over from an offender standpoint, because if you're trying to burn items that might not burn that well, and the fire is put out quickly, you've now drawn attention to those items and the fact that there was an attempt to destroy them. So links between those items and then the dead body that shows up 2 days later nearby are going to be pretty easy to draw. So you have to be careful.
The fire's location almost certainly would have precluded an immediate response, giving the arsonist ample time to leave the scene and for the intended items to burn before recovery. The subsequent decision by the fire chief to allow the structure to burn to the ground was unlucky for future investigators. What was left unscorched, however, also caught Dr. Ferguson's attention. Remember Jennifer's abandoned Jeep? It was about 7 miles away from where her body was found, and it was untouched.
The other thing about the Jeep not being burned is that if you're thinking about destroying evidence, firstly, it goes to the fact that there wasn't probably evidence in there. So she likely just walked away from it and went somewhere else. And also the potential for like a spatial difference between where the Jeep was and where the homicide was. If it took effort to go back to the Jeep, or if it was starting to be daylight and the opportunity was diminishing for getting rid of the Jeep, etc., that could help explain that lack of attention to that massive piece of evidence that the offender hasn't really tried to do anything with. From an offender's perspective, the Jeep is quite useful because it allows for that conjecture, I guess, or that mystery surrounding, did she hitchhike? Did she walk into the woods and commit suicide? Did she go for a swim and drown, etc.? So it's convenient, really, to leave it there, especially if it's parked haphazardly and is going to draw attention, and the body's way over here and the Jeep is here.
Despite the fact that the Jeep created a lot of initial questions in Jennifer's case, Dr. Ferguson agrees with investigator Daryl Parker that Jennifer's body tells a story, and it's one of murder, not suicide or an accident.
I mean, not finding the clothes is a pretty good way to negate the notion that she accidentally drowned, for example. I think there's data about how women commit suicide and whether they're likely to be naked. And I don't think they are. And if that was the idea, that she was going to go drive around and then go swimming, like somewhere out, you know, in the creek or whatever, then she probably would have brought her dog.
Jennifer's dog, Patton, was also an indicator for her family. Back when Jennifer was classified only as a missing person, one of the things her sister, Alyssa, and Grandma Mimi held on to was the fact that she had left Patton behind. They thought surely she would return for her dog, who she called her baby. But remember, there was talk of another baby, one who Jennifer indicated also belonged to Rob Holman, just like their beloved black lab, Patton. Dr. Ferguson had some compelling details to share about arson and intimacy.
I wanted to talk about a couple of the statistics that came up in your study. It talked about how the largest portion of arson-associated victims were the current intimate partner of the victim, and only a small percentage were the ex-partners. You know, I think it was the current intimate partner was 23% and the ex-partner was 3%. You know, in Jennifer's case, her ex-husband was also her current intimate partner by both of their admissions. So it's sort of an interesting crossover there.
They're very muddy, those conceptualizations. I mean, the definitions vary depending on the study that you're talking about, who is considered ex or not ex. A lot of research actually just puts them together because it's too hard. Like, if someone's separated but not legally divorced, is that ex or is that still current? So I think in hindsight, if we did this again, I would probably just lump them together. But you should look at the numbers together is the point.
Okay.
There is a link between intimacy and arson-associated homicide.
As we all know, Jennifer had two intimate relationships around the time of her disappearance. Her ex-husband, Rob Holman, and her ex-boyfriend, James Hamilton. It's no surprise that law enforcement identified both men as persons of interest in Jennifer's death. But perhaps the most intriguing evidence in Jennifer's case is her belief that she was pregnant and her desire to tell everyone that the baby's father was Rob Holman. According to Rob's own statements to police, he believed that this information would ruin his new relationship with Sarah Beth, the woman he hoped to marry.
In terms of ruining a new potential relationship or an existing relationship with someone that you want to marry, if that's not a strong motivation, then, you know, what is?
But lest we forget, Rob's fraught relationship with Jennifer wasn't the only one in the picture.
On the other hand, too, if separation is shown in the literature, like from James, as being a major risk factor as well. Just that act of separating. And pregnancy by someone else would be probably another massive risk factor. Applying separation as a risk factor for intimate partner femicide is tricky because you have to think about it from the offender's perspective. When is the separation? So it might not be when she moves out. It might not be when the divorce is finalized. It might be some little thing that makes him go, okay, she's actually gone now. That's the separation for them. And in a case like this, if he did know about the pregnancy, that could be a trigger as well. Pregnancy to someone else that isn't me.
Dr. Ferguson was also drawn to several facts about James Hamilton, specifically that he had an allegation of putting his hands on Jennifer's neck in the past.
The first one that I have to say about James is I heard that he admitted, or there was some history of strangulation where it was set up something about a rocking chair or something.
Yes.
A history of strangulation makes the woman 8 times more likely to be murdered by that person.
Wow.
So that is like a alarming statistic. The other thing is that in the concealment literature and what we know about detection avoidance in intimate partner femicides is that offenders are often over the top cooperative. So cooperation doesn't necessarily mean that they're trying to clear themselves, as I'm sure the investigators would understand. However, what that cooperation is often very self-focused and self-absorbed. So offenders who do cooperate because they've concealed it and, you know, they want to get their narrative to be accepted generally will firstly malign the victim, talk about her as being crazy and, you know, whatever, suicidal, blah, blah, blah. And they'll try to sort of ramp up that side of things, to blame her for the death a lot of times. But they also are just very self-focused in terms of pushing their own agenda. And that's why they're helpful and cooperative. So it's all about setting the story from their perspective and making sure that what investigators hear from others about the relationship, for example, that they can kind of front foot anything that makes them look bad. So that's what the helpfulness and cooperation is about.
While noting that she was suspicious about James's cooperation with the investigation, Dr. Ferguson also pointed out something from James's behavior during his interview with police that to her actually bolstered his claims of innocence. And it was a detail that stood out to the original investigators as well. James's insistence on keeping his cell phone turned on and in his hand during the entire interview at the sheriff's office while Jennifer was still a missing person.
The thing about not wanting to hand over the cell phone because of a fear of her calling and him not having the phone or no one answering sprung to mind to me as important, because it's not that manipulative helpfulness that you see in people who conceal homicides. It's much more genuine about an actual concern for making sure that someone is there if she calls.
The investigation into Jennifer's murder has taken plenty of twists and turns, including detours for eyewitness statements. I wanted to get Dr. Ferguson's take on the account of Deborah Lambert, the Oklahoma woman who believes she saw Jennifer Harris being accosted by three men on the Red River Bridge on Mother's Day 2002. If you recall, Deborah identified Rob Holman from a photo lineup as one of the people she claims she saw on the bridge that day. To put it mildly, Dr. Ferguson did not find Deborah's statement to be credible.
I mean, if he's recruited a couple of people to help him kill Jennifer, firstly, completely unnecessary, because he could easily get her alone in a remote location, like he has a million other times. Secondly, if that was the case, then like he would give himself an alibi with these other two people, instead of his alibi being, I was driving around aimlessly and no one can account for me. Like, surely if it was planned to that extent of having two accomplices who now have not said anything for years, they would have incorporated that into an alibi.
For what it's worth, investigator Daryl Parker also discounts Deborah's statement, mainly for the reason that it doesn't fit into the established timeline of Jennifer's disappearance. But more on that in our next episode. In Dr. Ferguson's research, the likelihood of multiple people being involved in Jennifer's murder and evidence disposal is quite slim. In the study, 91% of offenders in arson-associated homicides acted alone. And speaking of rare circumstances, Dr. Ferguson's study also found that 98% of offenders set only one fire in the 24 hours after committing murder. As we've already covered, there were reportedly two fires set in a short time frame on the evening that Jennifer disappeared.
Well, okay, so when you first said that there was two fires, my initial gut reaction was, this is going to be teenage boys unrelated. But the fact that they're far apart, and the fact that in the second one, there was a single guy, what looked like a single guy in a pickup truck, makes me think one of two things. Either they're unrelated to each other, or that the second one is subterfuge for the first one. So the second one is designed to draw attention away from, in case someone calls in the first one. Hopefully the volunteer firemen will be over here at this residential one, and this one will have time to burn. But that depends on how closely together they were lit, etc.
The fire chief at the time gave a statement saying that he was on his way to the fire on the riverbanks when he got a second call about the residential fire.
Dr. Ferguson was curious about how common suspected arson was in Fannin County back in 2002, and I had wondered that myself. I'd already made an open records request about it and gotten a reply from the Texas Department of Insurance. the report showed an annual total of 46 fires that were listed as undetermined origin, and of those, 11 were listed as intentionally set.
Intentional fires up to less than one a week, maybe intentional, and you've got two in one night. It's pretty different.
While Dr. Ferguson's study focused on arson in Australia, she also took into account landmark studies from other countries, including one from the U.S. that examined 183 arson-associated homicides in America from 1985 to 1994.
I just want to read you this quote from an American study that was done on arson-associated homicides. It says, "This finding lends support to a hypothesis that fire, an unnecessary aspect to the killing, is a form of overkill. Overkill is found in between 46 to 90% of intimate partner homicides and can result from intense anger that develops within a troubled relationship between intimates." The other thing I think that's really important that comes out of the research is the link between arson and solvability. So, like, we know that actually arson works, especially secondary arson, to make crimes more difficult to solve. In primary arson cases, sometimes it can actually work against offenders because you have more resources that are put to investigations, because you have like a fire department or fire investigators as well as police. But in secondary arson cases, because of the active destruction of evidence, we know that it actually does reduce the likelihood that the homicide will be solved, and significantly.
While fire is an excellent way to dispose of many items, there are certain materials that are generally known not to burn to the point of extinction, like metal.
This is like completely baffling. Just a few days after, there was a local Bonham resident who allegedly called the police department and said, "I found some Jeep keys out on the side of the road, and I'm going to put them for you on my porch." It would have been great if they would have said, "You stay right there, we're coming to you," or "Drive them up to our department right now." But apparently what happened is there was no real urgency. And he said, "I'm going to put them out on my porch for you. You come get these keys." And by the time the sheriff's deputy went out to the porch to retrieve the keys, they were no longer there. And the resident said, "Like, I don't know what happened to him. I left him here for you. And now they're gone. And you have these mysterious Jeep keys that are consistent with what Jennifer's keys would have been like, that just never make it into law enforcement's hands, as far as we know."
And someone would know that. Like, there's no point chucking those in, because firstly, it would be a red flag that this is potentially linked to her, if you can see that the key is a Jeep key.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's evidence that can't be destroyed. So we'll get rid of it in a different way by throwing it out the window or whatever.
When I visited the scene with investigator Daryl Parker, he pointed out how close the discovery of the keys was to the fire at the Whitlock property, both in timeline and in geography.
Up here on the road, where these keys supposedly were found, and this is, again, anecdotal, can't prove it.
Right.
But there's another driveway.
Okay.
About 100 yards this way. Halfway between these two driveways, these keys were supposedly found on the side of the road.
Okay.
And it makes sense. You're the killer, right?
Right.
You take off, you're in your truck, and you look, and oh, there on the seat are her keys. Keys don't burn. So, see that other driveway?
Yeah.
Somewhere between here, he throws them out the window. Well, this patch of the side of the road had just been mowed, like the day before.
Okay.
And this brush-hogging crew had supposedly kicked these keys out. A man finds them, calls the sheriff's department, says, "Well, if you want them, they'll be on my porch," and then they disappear.
And that was right here?
That was right here. So yeah. If that story is true, which I can't confirm.
Sure.
And the cottage burns down the same night, and it's the only place where you can get to the water. I mean, what else do you need?
Right. It does seem like a pretty strong connection to this being the place where Jennifer's body went in the water,
mm-hmm.
where her clothes and purse were destroyed,
right.
and where her keys were discarded.
Yeah. Now, I'm a criminal defense investigator.
Right.
So I know from the defense side, I would be like, okay, show me the keys.
Yeah.
Why do you think that it happened there? What's your evidence? So I can't, and the only answer to that is, look, it's circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence means you don't have to have hard forensic evidence. It's just a set of circumstances that piled on top of each other mm-hmm. make the result inescapable. So.
Yeah. It'd be one thing if all you had was the fire.
Right.
All you had were the keys.
Right.
Or all you had was, well, it's 2 miles from where her body washed up.
Yeah.
But you have all three of those things.
Well, I would say, honestly, if we're really getting down to it, the only thing we have is we have a very tight timeline. And he was the last person to see her alive. And she met someone at the hoedown, which is an isolated place. A person who's not familiar with the area wouldn't have been able to find it. And then she disappears.
On the next episode of Final Days on Earth, the life and death of Jennifer Harris. Daryl Parker takes me through his timeline of the case.
Starting route to 416 East 9th Street.
So I know it's been 20 years, but have there been a lot of development around here, or does this pretty much mirror?
No, this is still pretty much the same place.
We're going back to Bonham, and we're taking you along for the ride.
I've done this before, but I'll do it over and over and over again, because one of these days, I'm going to have to testify.
If you have any information about the unsolved murder of Jennifer Harris, contact the Fannin County Sheriff's Department at 903-583-2143. Final Days on Earth is recorded in Dallas, Texas for Cold Case Productions in partnership with Podcast One. This episode was written and reported by me, Claire Sanimal, and Hillary Wadsworth. Audio production by Matthew Malinger of Podcast One. Original theme music composed and performed by Riley Simmons. Associate producer is April Scales. Field producer is Molly McEwen. Editorial consultant is Lucy Scott of lucymedia.com. Executive producers are Sharon Richards and me, Claire Sanimal. Special thanks to Alyssa Harris-Warnick, Daryl Parker, and Fannin County Sheriff Mark Johnson for talking to me in this episode. If you enjoy listening to Final Days on Earth, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Good Pods, and anywhere else you listen to this podcast. Thank you so much for your support.